I'm Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Let's have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in their own personal stories, describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in the room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too, I must have this thing. I have the privilege of introducing our speaker tonight, who is a woman that I know, but because of this program, I cannot quite figure out exactly when I met her, but it's, you know, if you stick around long enough, you will run into people later and go, I know you, and I know her. So I'm going to find out how much I know her when she tells her story, and it'll all come streaming back to me. We've got to give you air. Hey, I'm Eric. I'm an alcoholic. Yes, we will figure it out. We'll figure out where we know each other from. So thank you, Tim, for asking me to do this. We'll work it out, you know. I'll just talk loud if I need to. So I always try to be of service if I can. So if somebody asks me to speak at a meeting, if somebody asks me to chair a meeting, to lead a meeting, I always, if I'm available, if I'm in town, I always do it. And that's one of the ways that I stay sober. My sobriety date is May 20th, 2013. And I did not bring my notes with me today, so I prayed before, as my sponsor instructs me always, and whatever comes out, if you don't like it, blame my higher power. But when we tell our stories in AA, we tell them, we say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'm going to walk you guys through that, through the journey of Erica. So I'm originally from Augusta, Georgia, which is about 2 hours east of here. I was born and raised there, and I'm going to disclose a few things about myself just to kind of give a baseline. So I'm biracial. So my dad was black and my mom is white, and that is a huge part of my life and a huge part of how I grew up and how I always felt different and apart than and apart from others. When I grew up, from kindergarten through eighth grade, I went to a Catholic school that was mostly white kids. And my dad used to like to say that, you can count the children of color on one hand with fingers left over. So I was different in that way. They also had a lot of money. We weren't poor, but we didn't have the kind of money that they had. So, you know, they would be able to do things like go to social and, you know, do these kinds of activities that I just couldn't do. So I was different in that way. I was also overweight as a kid. So just any way that I could stick out like a sore thumb, I did. And, you know, I felt that a lot of my life. And I'll also just kind of qualify and say my parents were divorced since I was 18 months old. So I lived with my mom and my grandmother, and I went to see my dad pretty often. My dad was one of us, and he and my mom were in a heated custody battle throughout most of my childhood. So childhood was very turbulent, tumultuous, like just not a fun time for me. And I spent a lot of time going back and forth between my parents' houses. And my parents always, I mean, Augusta's a small city if anybody's ever been there. But, it's like three exits on the highway. My parents lived close to each other. So even though my dad was an alcoholic, and I kind of get into what that experience was for me. And my mom never drank a day in her life, but she, or that I know of anyway, but she's mentally ill. So, that definitely affected me. So I'll also say that my grandmother, my mom's mom, so she's Caucasian, she said something to me one time. I think I was like 12. I was being a jerk because that's what 12-year-olds do. And she said, "Oh, do you think it's nice having an interracial person in the family?" And then she And then, of course, I went in my room and, like, shut the door and started crying. And then she came up to, you know, came to the other side of the door, and she was like, so I was like, I'm sorry, do you want me to give you $5? And, you know, I was just like, my mom was obviously very upset. But I tell you that to just say that the differentness that I felt throughout my whole life, it was, I was given the message that, you know, I was different, and who I was, even down to my DNA, was not okay. And so the way that I dealt with that when I was a child was I, from a very early age, I found a way to escape. So I would escape through TV. So watched a lot of Nickelodeon in the 90s. If you ever are going to trivia and you need somebody to help you out with 90s Nickelodeon, I'm a girl. I can still sing the Stick Stickly song if anybody knows what I'm talking about. So that's, you know, that's what I dealt with. That's how I dealt with it. And also food was my first love as well. So, you know, had a lot of different things going on. Didn't really get to be a kid. Didn't really have a parent that was a parent. And, you know, so I kind of, because of that, I kind of parented myself, or just kind of made my way through life. And I led a discussion at my home group, which, by the way, my home group is the Vinings Women's Meeting Saturday morning. It's an awesome meeting if you ladies want to check it out. And one Saturday out of the month, we read a story from the book, and the story that we read this past Saturday was Because I'm an Alcoholic. And in the very beginning of the story, the woman says, you know, I just kind of did the motion, went through the motions and did what other people were doing to kind of, to feel okay and to kind of learn what I was supposed to do. And that was very much how I was. I just kind of watched other people, and I raised myself by observing what other people did to know what the right actions were. And because of that, I didn't really get to know who I was as a person. And, you know, I didn't go through all that, the formidable years that, you know, that a child goes through to kind of learn things. So that was kind of my early childhood. And I'll say that, you know, when I went to that Catholic school, kindergarten through eighth grade, I stood out because I was one of the only children of color, as my dad would say. When I got to high school, I went to an 80% black school. So it was a culture shock for me in a different way. And I didn't really, throughout school period, I had maybe like one or two friends. So I was also not really social. I was kind of a shy kid, you know, just had like one or two people that I would be close with, and that was about it. But when I got to high school, I had a friend with me that had been at this Catholic school with me that I went to, and, you know, we just were, did the things that, you know, girls do. We were on the phone for hours for no reason, and mom would be like, get off the phone, what are you doing? And we were just talking about nothing, you know, and so we were like sisters, and I still talk to her today. I still consider her a sister, even though we're not close anymore. But the more I got entangled with this friend, you know, she started to do drugs and things like that, and I was always afraid of that. And my dad, you know, he was one of us, and through this program, I was able to finally understand that hurt people hurt people. And, you know, when I was younger and all through my childhood, my dad would constantly criticize me. He wasn't physically abusive, but he was definitely emotionally abusive. You know, he would call me fat, stupid, and then, you know, later when I would confront him about it or ask him about it, he would be like, what are you talking about? And I thought, you know, he was in such denial. And then I realized when I came into this program that he was probably in a blackout when he said those things. And so I also, you know, through that, even though we had that kind of relationship, I was very afraid of him. I'll also say this, I also developed this sort of Jekyll and Hyde that the book talks about very early, even before I started drinking. Because of my dad, I was kind of afraid of him, and I was a sweet little angel at his house. And when I was at my mom's house, you know, I didn't really have a whole lot of respect for her. I realize now I was just angry because she couldn't be my mom, really, in the way that I needed a mom. And so I was a little turd to her. So I was like two different people from a very young age. And, you know, so all this stuff going on, back to my friend who got into drugs, I was afraid of my dad. I was afraid that my dad would find out. And so I didn't really get into that. I was kind of like a goody-goody. And then I remember also in high school. So that's when I started to lose weight, and the wrong boys started to come out of the woods. And, you know, it just, but I still, even though I started to lose weight, that still didn't fix me. Like, I didn't feel better. And I can remember my first drink was prom night junior year, and I was with this friend who was into the drugs, and her boyfriend, and this other guy that I liked who didn't like me back, so that was another just teenage drama. And my first drink was Bacardi O, and if you guys remember those, and you know, I just remember that feeling of, and I hear a lot of people talk about it, but that feeling of like, I'm okay now. And I don't care what other people think about me. And I can say what I want, and it's fine. And, you know, that night I was funny, and I was the life of the party, and it was great. And that first experience that I had, I didn't get sick from it. I didn't, you know, get a hangover or anything like that. I went to my mom's house that night when I, you know, I got home, and my mom didn't know. And as I mentioned, she's mentally ill. She's never been diagnosed with anything, but I believe she's autistic. Just from, you know, some of her traits. And so she didn't notice. And I also, you know, the older I got and the more I'm in this program, I kind of realized that a lot of the stuff that I did when I was younger was taking advantage of her mental illness that I didn't really want to acknowledge was there when I was younger. So anyways, I came home. My mom didn't know. And from that point on, I remember thinking, you know, this is great. Like, I need to do this again. And so I didn't get the chance to drink very often. Another thing from the lady in the story, where she, you know, I got the chance every time I got the chance, I would drink. And when I got my hands on something like Bacardi O, I would try to think of how can I get drunk faster. So I would take shots of it. I would drink it through a straw, you know, like whatever I could do to try to get drunk faster, because I wanted to get that feeling back of, you know, I feel great. I don't care what anybody thinks about me. All the voices that tell me that I'm not good enough, stop. So, you know, I continued drinking through high school whenever I got the chance, and it was great. I didn't have hangovers. I didn't have consequences. My mom didn't know. My dad never said anything because he, you know, he worked nights, and I was staying at my mom's house, and so he, you know, I never saw him. Although I will say I started to kind of get manipulative because I would come home, and I knew my dad would drive by my mom's house before he would go to work to see if I was at home, and because at this point I had a car, and so I would come home before I knew my dad was going to work, and I wouldn't go in the house though. I would just lay down in the car, and then when I knew he was at work, then I would leave again, and I would go back out to my friend's house and do whatever. And you know, that's kind of how, like, I started, you know, just whatever I can do to get drunk whenever I can. That's, you know, that's what I just made it a point to try to get that feeling whenever I could. So I got to college, and throughout this, like, one of the things that I was always, I never wanted to slip was my grades. I always studied hard. Well, I studied, and, you know, I wasn't the best person in the class, but I made A's and B's, mostly A's, and I was very proud of that. And that was one of the only things that my dad ever praised me on, was my grades. And so I actually also, when I was in high school, towards the end, I was taking joint enrollment classes. So I would go to high school in the morning and college in the afternoon. And I just wouldn't go to class sometimes. And my grades started to slip in certain classes, those morning classes. And I would actually change my report card when I gave it to my dad. And so just, I tell you that also just to say, like, kind of the manipulative things that I did that I didn't really realize were manipulative. You know, I just thought, you know, I'm afraid of my dad. I don't want to hear, you know, I don't want him to know these things. Like, so I'm just going to change it and try to make my outward appearance look fine. So anyways, get to college, and that's how I came to Atlanta. So I went to Georgia State in 2005, and I didn't know anyone. I think there were, like, a couple of people from my high school that went there, but I didn't know them. So that feeling of, you know, just lonely and afraid and not, you know, not really knowing anyone, not really great with making friends. So I joined a sorority. And the sorority that I joined is a multicultural sorority, so I thought, okay, there are other girls here that look like me, that are mixed like me, so now I'm going to fit in. Now I'm going to feel okay. And I'm glad that I joined the sorority, and I'm still friends with many of those girls today, but that didn't fix me. And I can remember, you know, we would go to parties, and I was the youngest one. I was, you know, again, outward appearances, I was 18, I was the youngest one, and I was the youngest president in the chapter, and, you know, all this stuff to make myself look good. But I was the one that wanted to do the most drinking. So we would go out, and I, of course, well, I was 18, I wasn't old enough to drink, so I would get them to buy drinks for me. We would drink before we went out. And I can remember things started to get worse. So remember I told you I didn't have hangovers? That started to happen. The consequences started to happen. And I'm going to tell you a few stories, but I don't want to make this a drunkalogue. I just want to kind of, I need to claim my seat here, and I need to remember these things too. I need to constantly remember where I was so I don't go back there. I can remember one day we were going to a frat party, and so we drank McCormick's before we went to the party. And if anybody knows what McCormick's is, it was like in the plastic bottle on the bottom shelf. It was like the $10 vodka. And so we drank a bunch of that before we went to this party. And then we got to the party and we drank this drink called, I can't remember what the name of it was, but it was like Golden Grain and Tequila. It was, had some like stupid name, like, don't drink this. I was like, yeah, let me drink that. So I got super drunk, super, super drunk. And I didn't have a blackout, but I had a brownout. And so I remember, like, well, I guess it was a brownout. Like, I remember certain things. It wasn't like, you know, the whole night was gone. And I remember falling down the stairs. Well, I don't remember the act of falling down the stairs, but I remember that I fell down the stairs. And then one of the frat brothers came up to me and he said, are you okay? Because we don't have insurance. And I was like, haha, okay, it's fine. And, you know, I didn't know that, you know, I didn't know what was going on. I didn't care. You know, they got me back to my sorority sisters. We went back to one of their houses, and I had parked my car. If anybody knows, remembers where the lofts were at Georgia State, or are at Georgia State, I parked there. And you can't park there after a certain time. So my car got towed. So I'm at her house, just drunk, and my car is in my dad's name. And so I realized the next morning, I'm still drunk, I realized my car has been towed, and I have to get my car back, and in order to get my car back, I have to go through my dad. So I call my dad, and, you know, I tell him my car has been towed, and I don't remember, honestly don't remember what story I told him. I don't know if he figured that I'd been drinking or what, but he didn't say that, and he, you know, we proceeded to get my car out of the A-tow, and, you know, I also, like, my ankle is sprained at this point, so I'm, like, limping, I'm still drunk, I'm at A-tow, my dad had to, like, you know, he was old school, so he had to, like, fax some paperwork over, so it was taking forever, and, you know, and I'm still, like, I'm kind of thinking it's funny, and I remember taking pictures with my other sorority sister that took me there, and those pictures are still up on Facebook today. Like, if you go back to, like, that, to like 2005, they're still up there. And I should probably take them down, but when I see them, it's a reminder of what I did and what I was like. And so, sprained my ankle, and I was supposed to go to work, and I worked for the school. And, you know, I made up some story about how I, you know, well, I fell down the stairs, which I did, but I completely didn't say I was drinking or anything like that. And, you know, just all of this stuff that, like, the lie started. And, you know, just the, you know, now you're starting to black out or brown out, and now you're starting to have to make up even more stories. And then, you know, things like the hangovers would come. And also I want to mention, too, after that incident at the frat party, I said, well, maybe I'm just not going to drink alcohol from a plastic bottle anymore. So maybe I just need, like, some more expensive alcohol because that's going to be better. I started getting violent when I drank. I can't remember a time specifically where this friend that I had from the middle or fourth grade through high school, I was at her house or a friend's house, and she said something, and I'm pretty sure it was a racist comment, but I don't remember. I just remember her saying something, and then I like hit her, and then I fell, hit my head on the concrete, and had to go home to my mom because I was at home that weekend. And you know, things like that would happen, and I would have a hangover, and the blackout started to get worse. And you know, I would then tell myself, well, maybe I just can't have vodka because vodka makes me violent, so I'm not going to have that. So then I switched to gin because that makes sense. So, you know, I got a little bit older. Things kept happening. You know, that feeling we talk about of, you know, when you black out, you know, when you come to, it's like, okay, well, let me check my bank account. Let me check where's my car? Is my dog still in the house? How much money did I spend? You know, all those things we have to kind of like piece together the night before. And that started to happen more and more. And that terrified me. And when I got sober, I actually researched what happens in your brain when you black out. And alcohol affects your short-term memory. So basically what's happening is the lights are on, but nobody's home. So you're just like, somebody's flying the plane, but there's nobody there. So that absolutely terrified me, that like feeling of not knowing what happened and having to piece together the night before. And that feeling just started to get worse and worse. And there were times where I would have these incidents, and you know, I'm losing my train of thought, but it just got like this feeling of, you know, I don't really know what's happening. I don't know what's going to happen when I drink. I don't know if when I take a drink, you know, am I going to end up being violent? Am I going to be the life of the party? Am I going to get hungover? Am I going to be crying in the corner? You know, and just things like that kept happening. And I want to tell you one more story just about the insanity of it. So this was maybe a little while before I stopped drinking. I lived by myself at this point, and I had a neighbor who lived upstairs from me, and he looked like Jon Stewart, and I had a huge crush on Jon Stewart, and so I wanted to make it a point to try to hang out with this guy whenever I could, and this guy happened to be into cocaine, and I don't identify as an addict, and I did not have, I don't believe I had a problem with drugs, and I absolutely believe in singleness of purpose. But I'm telling you this story of me doing cocaine with this guy, and because I want to illustrate to you that's where alcohol had taken me. So I was at this point in the beginning where I was afraid to do drugs, and you know, I didn't want my dad to find out about it, and you know, I was like, I'm just, you know, just alcohol. And then, you know, I wanted to get that feeling of just, you know, make the voices stop. And then it, as the years progressed, it turned into, I don't care anymore. And one particular night when I was with this guy, you know, we had, we're doing cocaine, and I was drinking, of course, like tequila, wine, whatever. And then I decided I was going to smoke some weed, which I did not like weed because I would hallucinate and I would think people were mailboxes, and it just was not a fun time for me. And so I did all of that, and I can remember thinking, I just don't care. I just want to see how far I can go. And that's the point that I had gotten to. And, you know, I can remember, like, I have to tell one more story. This was my favorite story. So same neighbor. So we went to this bar called Church, that's in Edgewood area. And I was drinking gin because that was my drink of choice. And, you know, of course I had gin on the way there. So I had like a tumbler, not a tumbler, but like a little water bottle full of gin that I was drinking on the way there. And then I got there and I was drinking more gin. And then my friends lost me for a little bit. I couldn't tell you where I went, but they lost me for a little bit, and then they found me, and it was time to go. My neighbor showed up. You know, he bought me a drink. You know, they were like, it's time to go, and I didn't want to go, and I got really pissed off, Kentucky. And I actually, one of my friends who, bless her, is still one of my friends today, she's driving my car with me in the back seat, taking me, she knows where I'm going with this, taking me to safety, and I snatch her wig off twice while she's driving my car, taking me to safety, because I didn't want to leave. I didn't want the party to be over. And, you know, like, that's the kind of person I was, and I'd gotten in a fight in the street with them. Like, that's the kind of person that I was, that alcohol made me. And, so that scenario, that wasn't my last night of drinking. Like, I was like, whatever. I kept going. And then the next day, one of my other sorority sisters, this girl with the wig, she was my sorority sister, one of my other sorority sisters happened to be teaching in South Korea at the time, and I was Skyping with her, and she said to me, she was like, do you want to talk about what you did last night? And I'm like, how the hell are you in South Korea, and you know what I did, and I don't know what I did, you know? And so I can remember talking to her and another friend, and I just said, you know, first I said, well, somebody must have put me some vodka. That was the first thing I said, because that's how insane I was. I thought, you know, like, well, let me just change the type of alcohol, because then that's going to change the outcome. And, you know, then I said to her and to another friend, I was just like, you know, I wish that you knew where I was coming from. And I didn't really know where I was coming from, but I just wish that somebody else knew how I felt. And I felt so alone in that, you know, nobody understood why I drank. I didn't really understand why I drank. What I blamed it on was my circumstances, how I'd grown up. And at this time, my dad had gotten really sick. Because as you remember, I mentioned he was an alcoholic. And around this time, he had, he was also diabetic. And so, just to make a long story short, he got a cut on his second toe on one of his feet. And he went to the VA. He was also a veteran. And they gave him antibiotics for it, and they weren't working because he was drinking. And so that cut turned into gangrene. Gangrene turned into lost the toe, then he lost the leg, then he had a stroke, then he had a heart attack and had to have open heart surgery. And all this stuff was happening around the time as my drinking was getting more and more. And of course, this was happening to me, you know. And I said, I don't want to think about it, I want to drink about it, you know. And yeah, all of this, like, you know, it was just kind of like, you know, this is alcohol. Just in the beginning, it made me feel like, you know, the voices would stop, and then it became like a coping mechanism, and then it became, I need to do this to do anything. And the way that I was feeling towards the end of my drinking, and my last drunk wasn't even a terrible drunk, like it, I was at home, but the way that I was feeling is a lot like how Bill describes on page 6, which, and I have this highlighted in blue pen, which means it was one of the first things I highlighted, and it says, the remorse, horror, and hopelessness of the next morning are unforgettable. The courage to do battle was not there. My brain raced uncontrollably, and there was a terrible sense of impending calamity. And that's how I felt. Like, I felt like, you know, that shame and that guilt of, I don't know what happened exactly, you know, just that, like, feeling so, like, just guilty and full of shame and not really knowing why any of this was happening. And I had this thought May 20th, 2013, that was, you know, I either need to go to the hospital or I need to go to AA. And I didn't want to go to the hospital because I was kind of poor. And I didn't know if my, you know, I didn't know anything about insurance, so I was just like, let me try an AA meeting. And nobody had told me to go to an AA meeting. That thought just came into my head. And that night I went to Wayuka. It was a Monday night. I went to the Wayuka Baptist Church. And if anybody's been there, that is a really hard meeting to find. And I happened to see this guy walking, and I just followed him, and it turned out he was going to the AA meeting. And so I believe that I was led to that meeting by the Lord. So, anyway, so I went to that meeting, and I can remember, you know, I thought it was a men's meeting at first because there were no women in there, and then a woman finally walked in. I was like, oh, thank God. And, you know, I didn't share. I don't remember saying that it was my first meeting or anything like that, and I just kind of listened to what other people were saying. And at the end of the meeting, I said, I'm not okay. And I picked up a white chip. And then after that meeting, the women came up to me, and they gave me a newcomer's packet, which was a pamphlet. So I think they didn't have any newcomer's packets. They didn't want me to know that. So they gave me this pamphlet that I still have, and some of the women had written their numbers on it. And, you know, they said, call me, and they told me about 90 meetings in 90 days. And one of them invited me to coffee, and I would never have done that, because remember, I need alcohol to be in any kind of social situation. But for whatever reason, I said, okay, I'll go to coffee with you. And I started going to a meeting every day for the first 90 days. I went to coffee with that woman, and I started to really listen to what you guys had to say. And I felt, when I came in these rooms, I felt like, okay, now I'm understood. Now this is why I act the way that I do. Or this is, like, other people feel this way too. I'm not alone. And there are people in here who get it. Even though we don't have, you know, we might never, as it says in the book, we might never mix outside. We might have never met otherwise. But in here, you know, we have commonalities, and we all have been, as it also talks about in the book, it's like we've all been on that shipwreck. And it's like we are, you know, the survivors of this shipwreck. And today I really value the relationships that I have made in these rooms. And I feel like, you know, when I was younger or before, it was all about, you know, I had to have the alcohol to interact, but even the interactions that I had, it was like, you know, if I do this for you, are you going to like me? You know, it wasn't like I genuinely care about you. It was, I want someone to like me. I want someone to, you know, I want something from you. And today I'm not like, I don't have to do that. You know, I have genuine friends, and I have people that I genuinely care about, that I call them and I ask them how they're doing because I really care, not because I want something from them. And so, you know, I got a sponsor, and if anyone's in here and you need a sponsor, ask for a sponsor. It's okay. I felt like I was asking somebody to go to the prom. It is not that serious. I mean, it's serious, but it's not, you know, just do it. Your sobriety is the most important thing. And I got a sponsor. I asked, you know, I asked her to take me through the steps, and we started working the steps, and I started to feel better. I started to kind of, in AA, I started to, you know, start to develop, like, be with groups of people and start to, you know, kind of be a little bit more comfortable around people. I still felt a little bit awkward, but I kept going because that was where I got relief at the end of the day. And during those 90 days, you know, I would get up, go to work, come home, take the dog out, eat dinner, go to a meeting, come home, go to sleep, do it again. And sometimes on Saturdays and Sundays, I went to two meetings because that was what I needed to do, and that worked for me. And when I sponsor women, I suggest the same thing to them. And my sponsor that I started working the steps with, she's not my sponsor today. She eventually went back out, but I got a new sponsor that I have today and that I call every day, and that is just a huge voice of wisdom for me. And I definitely value my relationship with her. And so, you know, we got through my steps. I started sponsoring other women, got a home group, and I had that home group for about 4 years. And recently I changed my home group, and this is my experience. I will tell you, if you feel like you're not getting what you need from your home group, it is okay to change your home group. Your sobriety is the number one thing. That's what I needed to do for me. And because of that, I met some other lovely ladies. But I'll also just say that one thing that I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but, you know, the concept of a higher power. And I didn't mention this, but I grew up Catholic. And so Catholicism is very structured. And, you know, I went to a Catholic school, went to a Catholic church. So I went to church every Sunday, Friday, Wednesday. And so I always believed in God, but it was just kind of like God was there, but when I needed something, you know, just like, oh, I'm going to do my thing, you do your thing, it's fine. And in AA, I really love that, you know, Catholicism, I don't know that it's for me. Some people love it, and that is fine. It is a fine, fine religion. But for me, that didn't work for me. And so I love that AA allows us to develop our own relationship with a higher power of whatever we want it to be. And my relationship with my higher power is like a relationship with another person. It changes. It's not always fun. It's not always great. Sometimes, you know, we're like this, you know, we're solid. Sometimes we're not so much. And it's because I went away, not because my higher power went away. And I love that AA allows that, and that, you know, these steps are suggestions. And one of my favorite passages in the whole book is from the foreword to the second edition, and it says, "Upon therapy for the alcoholic himself, we surely have no monopoly. Yet it is our great hope that all those who have as yet found no answer may begin to find one in the pages of this book and will presently join us on the high road to a new freedom." And I love that because it's like, this is how we got sober. This is what we did. If you want what we have, you're welcome to join us. If not, cool, we'll be here if you want to come back. And I love that about this program, because if somebody had told me you have to do this, I don't really know how long I would have been around. And, you know, I will say that when I went through the steps, it's you know, they say sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I'll say my progression in AA has not been a, you know, just like that, I'm overnight changed. It's a progress. My sobriety is a journey for me. It's a spiritual journey, and it's always changing, always growing. And, you know, my sponsor says even if you, you know, take three steps forward and one step back, you still moved forward. You're still not back where you were. So, and I'll also say the promises have definitely come true for me. And that doesn't mean that you know, once I lose my fear of financial insecurity, that's always gone. It can crop back up. But the steps of this program helps me to get back in the middle of the bed. And, you know, I find that my higher power is always working in my life. And there are times that I can look back and see where God was dodging some bullets for me and, you know, got me out of some situations that I didn't want to, shouldn't have been in, that I wanted to be in, but I shouldn't have been in. It was good for me not to be in. But I'll share this story with you, too, of something that happened very recently. And you guys have heard this 5 times, so sorry. So I've been really unhappy with work lately. I am traveling a lot, and I don't like traveling a lot, and it's just getting me in a place that's very uncomfortable for me. And I've been feeling this way for a while, and my director, so my boss's boss, found out that I wasn't happy, and then my boss pulled me aside, and, you know, he was like, "Hey, you know, what's going on? How are things going?" And I stopped lying, and I was like, all of a sudden, I just started crying. And if anybody knows me, I'm not a crier. But, like, all of this, like, stuff had just built up, and it just came out. And we started talking, and, you know, he said, you know, like, yeah, I'm getting starting this up. I was just saying, you know, I have, like, it's not like I have a lot of things going on. It's just, like, a lot of little things, and this is throwing me off of my routine. And we started talking a little bit more, and we both kind of opened up. And he said something that caught my attention, and he said, "Yeah, there's a reason I don't drink." And I said, "Yeah, there's a reason I don't drink." And we figured out, you know, like, I figured out he's in the program, and he's been sober for 9 years. And I've worked for this guy for 2.5 years and had no idea. And so when he said that, you know, the feeling that I'd had of, like, the walls closing in on me, I didn't feel that way anymore. That doesn't mean I want to keep my job and I'm happy with it, but, you know, it just made me feel like, you know, like when the same feeling that I got when I came in these rooms, I'm not alone anymore. Like, he understands where I'm coming from. When I say things get me off my routine, he understands where I'm coming from. And so that experience I had was just, you know, it's one of those moments that I have with my higher power where he's, you know, he's just like, I'm here. I didn't go anywhere. So, yeah, that stuff like that has happened to me since I've been in this program. And, you know, I've learned to, as I mentioned earlier, I've learned to kind of, I don't want to say fully forgive my parents, because I'm still kind of working through that. Progress, not perfection. But it's helped me to kind of understand that, you know, like I said, hurt people. And it's helped me to kind of understand that, you know, my parents are just people too. And I learned some things about my dad that, you know, he didn't have a great childhood either. And so alcohol was his coping mechanism, and that helped me to kind of have some empathy for him. And my mom, you know, she's mentally ill, you know, and so because I've, you know, through the amends that I made with my mom, we don't have a, you know, we're not BFFs, but today we have a routine where, you know, she can text me or call me and we'll connect, and that is miles better than it was before. And so because of the things, because of the gifts of this program, I'm able to develop meaningful relationships with people, and I'm able to, I don't know, just have a real life and start to figure out who I am, which I didn't have before. And if I was still drinking, I probably wouldn't be able to do that. So, you know, if you're new, keep coming back, because this is absolutely worth it. It's been worth it to me, and I'm going to keep coming back. So that's it. Thanks.
First I slip, and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescue me, and finally, waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. Look into love's window for a heart that beats for me. Takes me where the promises are real. And I always long for something that set me free. Take me where the promises are.